This podcast is sponsored by Runway, air traffic control for your mobile releases. Put your releases on autopilot. Runway will shepherd your release from kickoff to submission to release with no manual intervention. A single source of truth for your releases. Runway integrates with your favorite tools for a bird's eye view over release progress and blockers. Make your releases collaborative. Get a rich, contextualized release runbook that makes capturing responsibilities and tracking tasks crystal clear. Get more control on your releases on App Store and Play Store. Point your browser to runway.team. Thank you for sponsoring my podcast. I'm also revamping my newsletter. Check it out, appforce1.net to sign up. You can also find a sign-up link on my Twitter profile. Okay, I'm sitting here with Paul Hudson. He's my next guest on my interview podcast. Basically, most people know him as being the person behind Hacking with Swift. But probably there's a lot more to this guy than only just his website. So we'll dig into that in this interview with him. And we'll see what kind of little gems we can dig up in his past. So hi, Paul, how are you doing?
I'm doing good, and I'm already confused. I'm pretty sure my life is like 24/7 Swift, or at least that's what folks tell me. Never sleeps, he's a robot, all that kind of jazz, you know? So yeah, it's just apparently non-stop Swift for me.
Yeah, I know what you're talking about, because every time that you publish something new on your website, people are also always amazed about how quick and how fast after the announcements and releases by Apple you actually have the content available. How do you manage that?
I think what people don't realize is that the majority of my content isn't publicly available. You're seeing a slice of what I actually work on. You know, I have books on macOS and watchOS, for example. I have a book on tvOS. I've got a whole Hacking with Swift Plus subscription, which is all for subscribers only. So when you see, oh yeah, Paul never sleeps, Paul works so hard, you're seeing 35% of my output, right? Imagine if you saw the rest of the stuff I'm working on, all the other things, all the book updates and similar. There's a heck of a lot that I'm working on. And I think nearly all of it comes from the same fundamental secret, which is far too much coffee. No, I'm just kidding. It is work on what I'm excited on. Okay. What I genuinely am jazzed about right now is what I write about best. And so people see me jump around wildly from I'm being totally psyched about watchOS to right now localization, and then next week, honestly, who knows? And I just get excited about stuff. I try stuff, break it, try stuff, break it again, and then write up my results. That's the entire Paul Hudson business marketing plan, such as it is. It's not very complex.
So how long have you been doing Hacking with Swift?
Well, I started it the same year Swift was launched. I started it in, I think, October that year. Mm-hmm. And off, you know, a month after Swift went final, Swift 1 went final.
So how many years is that actually? Because we're at Swift 5 now, so that must be like 5 years.
Swift 5, 3, yeah. So it was 2014 when Swift started. So a while ago now, yeah.
But what were you doing before Hacking with Swift?
I was a full-time iOS developer, like a lot of folks. And I had a lot of fun. You know, you can obviously, it was a great time to be an iOS developer. I was working full time on iOS from iOS, I think 4.2-ish, up to 10, 9, maybe 9-ish.
Okay.
And then obviously I've been doing iPhone OS before that. I did iPhone OS 3 beforehand, but that was not full time. That was just in my spare time. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was working as a developer, having a lot of fun.
Okay, so let's hit the rewind button, because when did you get an interest in programming, computers, electronics?
Oh, I'm one of those terribly boring geeks who did it from a very young age. And, you know, I remember back in the old days of computing, back when things were made of stone, you'd buy MS-DOS and it would come with a massive manual explaining how DOS worked. And it was a really comprehensive manual. It wasn't just like, you know, CD, MKDIR and so forth. Yeah, it was really thick. But at the back it'd say, hey, here's how you can make your own batch files. Here's how you can run commands and so forth. And I read through that and thinking I was some elite coder learning how to make batch files when I was in my early teens.
It makes the computer go beep.
Pretty much, yeah. I made increasingly complex batch files, very, very long eventually. And then ended up getting into Games Workshop, which I know that Guy Rambo got into as well. He also had Games Workshop as a way to make games as a kid and impress your friends by making games about them, basically. So hacking from an early age, just trying things out, you know?
So what make and model was the first computer that you got your hands on?
The very first one was a 286, but we only had it for a very brief period of time. The first one I really remember, the first actual PC we bought together, was a 486 SX25.
You know, the entire model number.
Oh, yeah. Well, I had a 127 megabyte hard drive. And I sound like when I was a teenager, people saying, when I learned to program, we had punch cards. And now I'm saying I had a 127 megabyte hard disk. You know, I was trying to explain to my kid that my Mac in front of me here has an 8 terabyte SSD. And like putting that into gigabytes first was a massive leap. And then from there to gigabytes, like the difference in the last 20 years is astonishing. Anyway.
Yeah, I got started on ZX Spectrums, the things by Sinclair. With the rubbery keyboards, you know?
Yeah, I was thinking of PC land. Yeah, of course, everyone had a Spectrum. We had a 48K, we had a Plus 2, we had a Plus 3. They were great machines. Mm-hmm. My dad actually made a game for Plus 2 years ago. Wasn't particularly good, but he certainly made one.
Yeah, I played a lot of Manic Miner, I remember.
Yeah, I'm trying to think. I played, what was the game? It came out to be in the way again. Gauntlet. I played a lot of Gauntlet. Okay. Gauntlet, a classic game, run around killing ghosts and stuff. That was a classic game.
So, but when you were messing around with DOS batch files, how old were you then?
You know, I guess around 13 or so, if I had to guess. It only really kicked off, I think, at 16, when... 15-ish, perhaps. I used to read magazines at the time regularly. There was one called PC Plus magazine that was very popular. I'd buy it every month. They'd have software on the front of the magazine to do stuff. And once they gave away a very, very cut-down version of Visual Basic, it was Visual Basic 4 Custom Control Edition, I think it was called. And it was designed so you could make your own controls, like little widgets, like a button or a gauge or whatever. And this was what I had to work with. I was working away. You couldn't show windows. You could just have one window and that was it. All you could do was this one thing. But then at 16, when I was 16, my brother went to university. He's older than me. And he signed up for Microsoft's student scheme. And they mailed him Visual Studio. His Visual C++, his VB6, everything. And I got, for my first time, some actual software I could build actual things with. And it kind of exploded from there. At 17, I took on vast amounts of PHP. At 18, I jumped ship to Delphi at the time. And it sort of just took more and more speed from there, really.
Mm-hmm. So did you have any formal education related to computer science or anything?
Yeah, like I said, one of those very boring kids who became laser focused on computing science. So for us, that's a GCSE at age 16, your exams. Yeah. And then it's A-level at 16 to 18. I had A-levels in computing science as well. And then a degree in computing science from 18 to 21. So it was computing science, computing science, computing science. And it was just becoming more and more blinkered, laser focused on this one topic. Nothing else mattered, just coding. Coding was my entire dream, and I was vastly misguided, but yeah, it was all right.
So what university did you do your studies?
The University of Greenwich in London, which is a beautiful building. It's the Royal Naval College, which is however many hundreds of years old, and it's a bit overawing, really, you know, huge pillars and columns and stuff with gorgeous painted ceilings and some students trying to sleep in the corner. But it was a lovely place to study.
It sounds like you have some fond memories of the place.
I do, yeah, I do. Mostly wasting time. I mean, I was a terrible student. I was really, really bad. I had such a long time of doing computing by myself that when they came in and said, hey, look, here's Java, I'm like, yeah, okay, Java. I remember that from a long time ago. Come on, let's move on to the next thing. It all felt a bit 5-10 years ago for me. And so I remember I looked at my exam results on the back of my certificate and I actually missed some final exams. I didn't even bother going to the final exams. I thought, I don't need this anymore. It's just pointless. Mm-hmm. I'd got my first job in March before graduation, which was in June. Okay. I basically walked out and went to a job instead. And I still managed to graduate with an upper secondary class degree. So I did okay, despite walking out on exams. I didn't focus, didn't care, didn't think, because I thought I was beyond it. And I was just doing so much better stuff in my head at the time. And I was wrong, of course, but there you go.
Okay. And you mentioned your first job. What was it?
It was doing web stuff at a sort of digital real estate company in the very center of London. Mm-hmm. They were a spin-off from an actual real estate company who used to build, you know, shopping malls and stuff. And they spent a lot of money, I mean, like silly amounts of money, building huge 4 or 5 meter models of shopping malls before mm-hmm. building them. This is exactly what's going to look like with people and da da da. And they spun off this company to say, actually, can't we just use 3D Studio Max at the time, now 3DS Max, to model the thing virtually? And so they were building this plugin so you could basically model in 3DS Max and walk around the world directly in 3DS Max mm-hmm. at the same time. And they brought me on at the time to do web stuff for them, to build the website, make the website work, and yada, yada, yada. And I did that. I brought in immediately brought Delphi in to do some internal tools. I started bringing PHP in. It was a lot of stuff being brought at the same time, just because I was kind of having fun.
Mm-hmm. So, and what year did you graduate?
2001.
2001, okay. So you worked at this real estate related company creating mm-hmm. web stuff to properly sell their their mock-ups and their actual product, which is shopping malls. Kind of yeah. crazy if you think about it. Mm-hmm. So how did you go on from there?
So after about a year, I was reading a magazine again mm-hmm. called Linux Format, because I was running all my stuff on Linux, Apache, MySQL, PHP, the LAMP stack.
Yeah.
And I read the magazine just to find out more about Linux. And it came with these cover disks where you can get Linux versions to try it and install, yada, yada, yada. It was great. Mm-hmm. And I, at this time, had been doing PHP for about 5 years.
Okay, so you're stuck with the first company quite long, actually.
No. I started in 97 doing PHP, approximately.
Yeah, yeah.
I did it through school, university, and then I did it at this company for 1 year at the time, 2002-ish. And the magazine said they had tutorials on Ruby and Perl. And actually, the Perl one was done by Charlie Stross, who now writes fantastic sci-fi books, by the way. Anyway, so they had no tutorial on PHP. And I thought, well, at that age, you have no idea how bad you are at the world or how clueless you are. You think you're great at everything. So I said, hey, I could write you a PHP tutorial. Mm-hmm. And they went, yeah, fine, sure, give it a try. I didn't tell the company. I just wrote a tutorial, mailed it off. They said, great, put it into print. Mm-hmm. And then another one, and another one, another one, da da da. And I think after like 8 issues, I realized they were hiring for writers, mm-hmm. for staff writers, which is sort of a position of which is basically a writing monkey, just come in and write stuff, basically. So I applied to be a staff writer at this magazine, Linux Format. Mm-hmm. They interviewed me, they told me how much they paid, which is way less than what I was on, because it wasn't in London anymore, it wasn't coding anymore, it was writing. I said, yeah, sure, sounds like fun. And I went, and they immediately made me what's called a reviews editor, which is a one up from a staff writer, but still fairly junior. And I left coding to mm-hmm. do magazines.
Yeah.
So I joined this magazine company. I moved to a town called Bath, which is where I live still, mm-hmm. Many, many years later, and worked as a journalist for the next 8 years.
So was that also the moment that you, was bitten by the writing bug, so to speak, so that you actually discovered that creating content and sharing it with the world was something that you actually liked doing?
A little bit. Mm-hmm. A number of things happened at the same time. Mm-hmm. First, I realized that being a journalist is great fun. I mean, honestly, I know it pays very badly, but there are very few better jobs in the world. Mm-hmm. You travel the world, meeting folks, interviewing them, having nice lunches, and fly home and write about it a little bit, and then go to the pub. I mean, yeah. We used to spend a long time in the pub planning the next issue, when really we were sitting there saying, huh, in Elite 2 Frontier, why did the spaceships have tires if they were in space? It's like just wasting hours and hours and hours of time while drinking lots of beer. Mm-hmm. It was a fantastic job.
Okay.
And that was one thing. I loved the job very much because it was a great job. It was going nowhere, but it was a great job. The second thing was that the company obviously had a vested interest in making me a better writer. Mm-hmm. And so they'd send me on training courses, regular training courses, to do writing, to do cover design, to do management, and much, much more. Okay. And the skills they taught me there, I still remember today. Mm-hmm. Very, very important things. I remember going onto a review writing day-long workshop, how to review a product. Mm-hmm. And after lunch, there was an activity with, like, I don't know, there's like 15 of us in the room from various magazines. There's me, PC Gamer, Tech Radar, whoever, around the room, right, from different magazines. And they said, okay, we've been doing a whole morning of practice so far. It's now the afternoon. Let's put your skills to the test. What you got to do is take these 8 bottles of water, like branded bottled drinking water, Evian and similar, and write a 200-word review,
okay,
of all 8 at the same time, like a group test. Which of these bottles of water is the best? And I wrote an atrocious article, like really bad, because I went, mm-hmm, okay, listen, you've got 200 words to write this thing in, you've got 8 bottles of water, you've got 12 and a half words to describe each bottle of water. So I wrote this thing that was basically like Morse code almost. It was like hardly anything in there, or like a telegram, you know. It was like really condensed words of stuff, and it was completely meaningless, not interesting, and a bad article. Mm-hmm. Whereas the next to me was I think it was PC Format, one of the games magazines at the time. They said, okay, there are 8 bottles of water. These 4, they're all junk. Forget about those. I won't even write about those. And they just picked 4, because water's water, right? Just, mm-hmm, these 4, don't care, toss them away. Or the remaining 4, these 3 are okay. I'll give those 40 words each. And the remaining one, this is the winner. I give it 80 words. And bang, they wrote a killer article. And so it forced me to recalibrate in many, many ways. Anyone could sit down and write 800 words about a random topic. Mm-hmm. Sitting down and writing 200 words about the right topic, that's significantly harder.
Okay.
So the company had a vested interest in making me a better writer, a better designer, a better editor of magazines. Mm-hmm. So there are a number of things happening at the same time. And of course, at the same time also, I had a lot of free time. So I was still doing vast amounts of coding for the magazine, writing tutorials on PHP or C# or Ruby or even Python sometimes, but also in my spare time, doing vast amounts on hacking on anything that stayed still long enough, basically.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so you were like a staff writer and then a review writer. And what happened after that? Because there's still some time between that and you starting hacking with Swift, if I'm correct.
Yeah, so I joined there around 2003, approximately. Mm-hmm. I lost track. And then I was roughly 8 years as a journalist, maybe slightly more. I can't quite recall.
Yeah.
The last 2 years or so, I was actually editor of the magazine.
Yeah.
Which is, again, great fun. You know, that's where every month you've got 132 pages that are completely blank. What do you want to put in there?
Yeah.
What's interesting right now? What is the zeitgeist of Linux right now? And so you're talking to folks, giving them ideas, getting ideas, you know, really in touch with the community. It's, again, a really, really fun job. But, you know, late iOS 2, early iOS 3, I'd already been hacking on, at this point, Windows Mobile, on Xbox 360, on Windows itself, on Linux. I mean, you name it, I've been making apps for it, because I just, and if it stays still long enough, I write software for, right? That's my way of thinking.
Yeah.
And then I wrote for iPhone, mm-hmm, at the time, for iPhone 3G. And yeah, around about iOS 3.1, I released my first apps to the App Store. Mm-hmm. Let me think, the company then said, hey, we think the iPad, which is just about to land, 3.2, is going to be absolutely huge. Mm-hmm. We want in on this money. We want to make apps for this. And they had this plan. Can we make 10 apps in the next 3 to 4 months? And they said, okay, we need to find someone who can do that. And I have to be there. They drafted me in. And we made a big, big stack of pretty big apps in, mm-hmm, a very tiny amount of time. And it was an absolute blast. I loved it.
Yeah, but that was the time that you could throw anything into the App Store and you could have some amount of success. And if you had a good app, you actually had great success then.
Yeah, but I mean, like, one of the apps I worked on for them was for a site called Cycling News, which is the world's biggest cycling website. And I made an app for them to do cycling news on the phone. So it wasn't like, hey, it's a throwaway app for fun. Mm-hmm. This is a huge app we made, yeah, to do a huge community. And it was just great fun because the company, they wanted results. They wanted success, but they didn't know what it looked like.
Yeah.
And so we're given a lot of free will to look around, try things, explore, and just explore and see what happens and get results that way. So it's quite exploratory, but I really enjoyed it. I mean, crikey, it was old Objective-C code, fine. It was a manky old Xcode version, fine. It wasn't very powerful. iOS devices, fine. But we still did a heck of a lot with what we had.
Yeah, spending a day on getting good scroll performance and stuff like that.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
So you were still working at the magazine then?
Yeah.
And so they basically, as a magazine, they got into iOS or app development, really?
Well, the magazine's irrelevant. The magazine at this point was still Linux.
Okay.
Was nothing to do with apps at all. This is all this freelance work. They'd say, okay, listen, Paul, you're not employed to do this. We'll pay you extra to do these apps. Fine. I'll happily take your money. And so I built, like I say, 11 or so apps for them.
Mm-hmm.
And then they said, okay, this has worked really well. We want to make an app team inside the company.
Yeah.
And at this point, I'd made stacks of apps for them, including some very important ones. I got lots of my own personal apps at this time. We're talking, you know, I think at least 50 or so at this point, personal apps.
Mm-hmm.
They obviously only had really one choice. So they brought me on as the app developer role to start a new team, hire a team to make app development a thing at the company. And our target then was iOS 5.
Yeah,
because iOS 5 introduced Newsstand, which of course would be a huge release for the magazine industry. And so we're working on a gigantic, gigantic app launch. I really want to push back to iOS 5. The company said, no, make it forward, iOS 4.3 or something at the time. So we're working this huge, I think the biggest app ever worked on, being pushed through quickly in time for 4.3-ish approximately.
Mm-hmm.
And then everything else, all our other titles were to land on iOS 5. So I was brought on to build a team. So I was hiring folks, interviewing galore, training them up, getting things moving, building a code base and promoting it as fast as we can to get things actually moving in time for iOS 5 and Newsstand.
Okay. So so you were working there, working hard by the sound of it. And at what point did hacking with Swift become an idea in your mind that you were thinking like, okay, I want to do something on my own, really, because to my knowledge, Hacking with Swift is your brand. It's your brainchild, actually. So how did that happen, actually?
Well, that came way later.
Yeah.
I had a lot of fun building apps, running a team. Mm-hmm. We ended up with 22, 23, I forget how many people on the team doing apps for the company. And we made a silly amount of money. The company made millions and millions and millions and millions. Mm-hmm. We licensed it out to Fender, to Peppa Pig, to UBS, to some massive companies who wanted to use our software, which is great. So the company, at the time, the company was often losing money over the year, never mind making money. If they made money, it'd be like, hey, we've made £2 million. And the app we built brought in, I think, $25 million, at least until I left the company in 2016. So that's for a company like that, it was a vast amounts of money out of nowhere. So they were very happy with that. but at some point, the app's kind of done.
Yeah.
You know, we've got our magazines on there. People are happy. They're subscribing. They're renewing. It worked very well. And when Swift launched, I could see the landscape changing very, very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
Our code base was, and I'm sure still is, extremely dated code. Because it had been from a young age hacked together and brought together and evolved. Da, 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 da. No one's sitting there saying, hey, let's spend money refactoring it and making it modern. That isn't going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
So Swift's changing. It's a new world. I start thinking, hey, I could get into this. I could start writing about this. And so I left the company.
Yeah.
At the time, I was senior in the company. I was a director of the company. And they said, listen, you can leave, fine, crack on, but you've got a 6-month notice period.
Oops.
6 months.
Yeah.
And that was fine. I didn't mind that because they said, okay, take it as gardening leave. Just go home and stay at home and do nothing for 6 months to avoid, you know, telling competitors, whatever, right? And so I was extraordinarily lucky. And I want to make this really, really clear. I was extraordinarily lucky to be paid to sit at home for 6 months. I had 6 months of guaranteed income when I could do whatever I wanted. I wrote during that time books, knowing that at some point my money will run out. You know, I'll have to get a new job. Will these books work? Mm-hmm. Or will I have to do more app development? Or will I have to go to London? Or who knows what? I thought I'll give apps a good shot.
Yeah.
And it worked out brilliantly. And I tried other things as well, but that was the biggest financial success.
In this 6-month period that you were writing books and stuff, did you actually publish those within those 6 months or at the end of the...
I published them straight away.
So straight it was away, like okay.
April 2016 was the first one that came out.
Yeah.
And I had Hack and Swift itself beforehand, the original iOS book beforehand.
Mm-hmm.
But the new books I published pretty quickly. Okay. And I was doing other work too. I launched this company. What year was it? I don't know what year it was. I get it hazy. It was a while ago now. I launched this company entirely around iBeacons.
Yeah.
So you could use my app for macOS to craft an app for iOS.
Mm-hmm.
Drag and drop sort of app builder thing for iBeacons, and it did extraordinarily well. It didn't make me any money. Well, okay, not much. It made maybe a few thousand, right? But the app itself was very, very popular. Autodesk used it, Verizon used it, GE used it, an unnameable fruit company used it in all sorts of ways. Didn't get much money from it, but it was very, very, very popular. and I thought, hey, this could work out as a business. And then actually, I realized books were a more fun, safer bet for me.
Okay, so you wrote the book Hacking with Swift, and then you thought, okay, let's build a website out of this. Or how did that happen?
There was a site too, but it was basically a sales vehicle for the book.
Yeah, so a landing page to actually
correct.
Get people enthusiastic about the book and actually
convert it into. The exact timelines are fuzzy in my head, but I had this idea where I make the website and folks would buy the book and that'd be it.
Mm-hmm.
But no one had heard of me. No one had any idea if they liked my writing or not. There was no free sample online or anything. Mm-hmm. So I ended up giving the whole book away for free. I said, just take it. Take the whole book. I don't care. Just have it all for free.
Mm-hmm.
Must have been 2015. Approximately. But, you know, Swift was 2014. So it must have been 2015. The book was just free online and to download as well. You could get it for free. Free. And then 2016, I think, approximately, I did this full time. I thought, okay, I can't continue giving away everything for free. I'll start charging for the book download. And immediately folks started paying because they liked the book online. They wanted to support my work. They started paying for it.
Okay.
But now there's a lot of free stuff online. I kept all the free pages online. So I started expanding that and building off that and seeing where it took me. And it grew very, very quickly.
So actually, you're saying you had the book available online for free, but people were willing to get the same content packaged as a PDF file,
which is still the same today. That's still exactly how it is today. You can read all of the Hacking with iOS book, UIKit, and now Swift UI edition, plus the videos, plus the challenges, plus the milestone guidance, and there's a heck of a lot of free stuff online.
Yeah,
I think it's possibly one of the largest Swift site in the entire world. And as a result, folks go, "Hey, this guy here is actually helping me out." Didn't have to give the stuff away for free. So they choose to buy my stuff or subscribe to Hacking Swift Plus or whatever. And that's just amazing. I'm very thankful for that.
Yeah, so you mentioned that about 35% of your content is available for free online.
Mm-hmm.
So it with Hacking with Swift, it's always been a big part of your formula to have like this free stuff online so that to actually get people familiar with your formats, get people enticed to want more, really.
I wouldn't say that, no. My goal isn't, I don't put stuff for free online to try and make a sale.
Mm-hmm.
You know, folks who want to support my work will support my work regardless.
Yeah, that's cool.
Of what I put for free online, which is amazing, and I'm so thankful for that. I do it because so many folks want to get into iOS. They know nothing right now. They're not CS background. They don't code. They want to make apps. And they haven't got the money to spend 50, 60, 70 bucks on a course or more. Put it online for free. Give them the chance to get ahead, make a start, start realizing their goals with Swift. And then if they like it, fine, they might come back. But you go through my Swift UI course and it's like 24, 25 hours of video, plus the UIKit course, another 30 hours of video, plus challenges, plus way, way, way more. It's a huge, huge site at this point. You don't have to pay me a penny. And I tell folks that. Don't spend any money. Don't give me your money. Go and read the online stuff. Fine. If you want to give me money afterwards, buy a book. You don't have to. Learn for free. You can do amazing things for free.
Providing this service to people is actually an enabler for your own success, really, because it really builds your brand online, being like, you know, Paul Hudson, Hacking with Swift. Every iOS developer that I talk to has heard about your content and has heard your name. I'm trying to see what is your motivation to actually keep going. And you mentioned already that you want to entice people to actually get into software development, to discover Swift really as a tool that they can use for their own success.
I think you have to understand that the fundamental difference between me and some other people, not everyone by a long way, but some other folks, is I'm aware very, very clearly what it takes for me and my family to exist, right? If you imagine X amount of money pays for my house, pays for the kids' food, clothes, car, whatever, right? That's what we need to survive, plus a buffer amount. We have some savings or a pension or who knows what, right? Yeah. So we aren't going to go pop in 6 months' time if things go wrong.
Yeah, just cover your financial security, really.
Right. After that, I don't need the money. After that, earning more money makes no difference to my life. I'm not going to go and stay in a 5-star hotel in London. That's just not who I am. And so I can afford to give away vast amounts of content, to do lots and lots of workshops for free, to buy conference tickets for folks who need them, to sponsor newsletters like iOS Dev Weekly or Swift Weekly Brief, to hand out donations to folks who need the money more than me. And that's a great position to be in. And you can see that in my work. You know, this year and last year I ran Hacking with Swift Live. We raised $30,000, I think, both times, if not more, for charity. I wrote the book, edited the book. I get everyone involved in the book and then edited all their stuff and designed the cover and da-da-da-da for Swift for Good, again for charity. I did some workshops at Try Swift. I didn't take a penny for that. I used all my income to buy diversity tickets for everyone who needed it. I sponsored IRS DevCamp DC, again, buying tickets for women who couldn't afford to attend. This is how I think my money ought to be spent.
Yeah, you want to make a positive impact on as many people as you can.
Exactly.
It sounds.
I've got 46,000 followers, Jiren.
Yeah.
If I'm not going to use what little platform I have to make a difference, what the hell am I doing it for?
True.
I can sit here and charge. I mean, some people will charge twice, three times what I'm charging for my courses. I refuse to do that. I have the only book on macOS, the only book on like watchOS. No one else makes this stuff. I can charge what I like. I don't want to do that. I want to help everyone reach their goals with app development. And that means keeping the price as low as I can afford. And when I make more than I have, getting rid of as much as I can towards good causes. And that's my entire ethos. I know what I actually need to get by, plus a buffer. Everything else I can do better with by handing it to somebody else.
It's amazing in a way that the part of your success is really the altruistic nature of the way that you provide the content. It's there is no benefit other than the benefit the reader of your content or the consumer of your content actually gets. It sounds like that and. It's amazing actually to see people that are able to like think beyond their own little box that they live in and just see what impact they can have outside of their little box, so to speak.
Honestly, I met someone in Toronto last year who was following my 100 Days of Swift course. And she'd come from a non-coding background doing the course, and she got to day 50 and she was offered a job doing app development. And I met her and she couldn't even speak to me. She was so happy to meet me. And that's an amazing privilege. That's why I do it ultimately. I get to meet these folks whose life I've helped. Obviously, I wrote the words and made the videos. That's the easy part. They've come along and they've put in the determination, the willpower, the fight to make it sink in and learn and stick to it. And that's really, really hard. So I'm doing the easy part here, but I still get to go to these events and meet folks whose life I have helped give a nudge along the way to make a difference. And that is an incredible, incredible privilege. And I love doing it. And that's the real payoff. Yes, some folks buy my books. Yes, some folks subscribe. And I'm obviously very, very thankful for that. But I try and focus on the people who haven't got the money for that. Vast amounts of the people who are supporting me do so knowing there's nothing in return. They know they're not getting anything back for their money. They know I'm using this money to fund my server or fund conference talks or fund who knows what that I can then teach everyone else and help everyone else. So these folks themselves are doing the same thing as me. They know they're lucky enough to have a good paying iOS job. They want to support other folks to be in that role who wouldn't otherwise have that chance.
Do you have any idea about how many people's lives you have impacted thus far?
I used to. The site has zero analytics on it. No Google Analytics, no trackers, nothing. There's only, I think, two cookies. One is from Cloudflare, because they do the performance balancing via the cloud thing they do.
Yeah, it's part of the protection that they provide with the service.
Exactly, yes. That's in there by default. And the other one is folks who log in to post to the forums, or if they are Hacking with Swift Plus subscribers, they have to log into that. So there's a GitHub token there as well. So that's it. That's all the tracking on my site. I cannot tell what people are reading. I can't say how popular things are. What I can say is we had tens of thousands of people complete the 100 Days of Swift, and the Swift UI course was on track to exceed that before I removed any tracking. So it was doing very, very well. And, you know, even today, yesterday, I mean, folks CC me in all the time. I get a little tweets whiz by, and I you know, if someone actually has a legitimate question, Twitter is the wrong place to ask me, because I can't track things at all. It's a flood of noise constantly, which
is a never-ending stream of messages.
Yeah, which is great. People want to talk to me, which is fantastic. But they ask me questions like, hey Paul, I've read your tutorial on X, how do I make it work with Y? I'm like, I don't know. That's not what the tutorial's not about. That, why are you asking me that? I've got no idea. Anyway, so they ask me stuff, and people post their certificates because they're really proud when they finish. And I think today or yesterday, someone, you know, got a distinction certificate from passing the Swift UI course, which requires a 95% pass correct rate in the final exam, which is really hard to do. And I see these all the time, and I love it. Mm-hmm. People are just so excited. And in fact, if you go to Twitter and just search for 100 Days Swift UI as a hashtag and go to latest, I go there regularly, like certainly once, twice a week, just to reply to folks. They're posting with that hashtag. I want to say, hey, well done. Good job. I love that you did with that design, whatever it is. A little encouragement does such a big, big difference. And again, these folks are not paying me a penny. They're on my site for free, watching the videos for free. Da, 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 da. I want to be there to cheerlead, to say, good job, well done. And that's, again, it's a really easy job. I've made the tutorials, I've written the projects, the source code, made the videos, and now I'm cheerleading. These are all the easy parts compared to the actual grit and determination of getting in there and fighting to learn it.
But is it also a big part of what motivates you to keep on doing what you're doing? Just seeing the results people are getting due to your content?
Partly.
Yeah.
It's a very similar job to working in journalism. I really, really enjoy my job. I mean, what is my job, right? I spend all day noodling around with Swift.
Yeah.
Trying things, building software, throwing it away. Mm-hmm. Trying something else, building that, throwing that away. Da-da-da. And eventually I find something I like. It's the best solution I've found so far. I'll write it up, publish it, and move on to the next thing. And when I think back to what I was doing before, when I was, you know, running this team of people, I wasn't doing that much coding.
No, I know.
I was a manager with managers below me doing other stuff. And I was doing some coding. Mm-hmm. I remember a few times, you know, real crunch coding jobs I was doing, but I was doing vast amounts of Jira, vast amounts of stand-ups and meetings and emails and organizing and one-to-ones, things that are really important. I love doing one-to-ones. They're amazing.
Yeah.
But they're not programming.
True.
And now, literally all my time is toying and having fun and exploring and pushing and breaking and learning about Swift and Swift UI and Combine and whatever.
And when there's not a worldwide pandemic going on, travel the world and talk about the stuff that you did, really.
Right, but that alone is a massive privilege.
Yeah.
You know, I 2018, I spoke at, I forgot how many, 12, 15 conferences, and again, 2019, many, many conferences. And that's a huge privilege to fly to somewhere, I don't know, New York or somewhere, or Singapore, and deliver a talk at a great event is amazing just by itself. Mm-hmm. But I get to then listen to 10 or 20 other speakers saying, hey, here's what's cool in Swift right now. Here's what's cool, again, again, again. And then folks say, hey, Paul, I love your videos. Check it out. And they'll show me their laptop with some code on. And they'll say, how do I solve this or whatever? And they show me their stuff and what's cool and what they're working on. Mm-hmm. And so I've got this constant flood of ideas coming in, things I'm trying to work and refine on, throwing away, trying, backed up by world-class speakers talking to me, teaching me what they're working on, backed up by literally thousands of folks saying, hey, Paul, check this out. emailing me the code or in conferences and so forth. So I've got this huge flood of ideas coming in constantly, and that is remarkable. I am so fortunate to be where I am. Obviously, it's a lot of work preparing, lots of conference talks. I don't repeat talks unless I've been asked to repeat a talk. So I'll do 12 or 13 or 14 or even 15 new talks in a year.
Yeah.
But it's a massive payoff. Mm-hmm. So many ideas just being thrown at me. I'm going, oh, that's cool. That's really cool. And just trying them out.
So just to get a little bit of a feel for how big the Hacking with Swift site really is, do you have any indication of the direct cost of running the website? So just your hosting costs to run the stuff?
So I switched to Cloudflare, which really helped.
Mm-hmm.
Before, it was, I think, $200-something a month just to run the server.
Yeah.
Never mind all the jazz around, you know, domain names or whatever. Just literally to host a server.
Yeah, just the capacity to actually respond to all the requests.
Yes, correct. That serves up from memory about 5 million page views. I forget how many individual users that ends up being.
Well, they're reasonable numbers, so to speak.
Yeah. Well, because folks come back regularly, which is amazing. I don't want to see, you know, a million page views from a million visitors. That's just they're coming back to the site once, which is like, you know, you go to some sites like a lyrics website. You want to know the song, Shake It Off by Taylor Swift. You want to know the lyrics, right? Go to the lyrics website. Every lyrics website ever has the most hideous design imaginable. They're all hideous. They're all full of adverts, editor. Because no one goes to lyrics sites proactively. No one chooses to go there. They go there as a result of some Google searches, click through and see it. And so they'll see a lot of page views matching up one-to-one with visitors because no one goes back there again. You go there once for your result.
Yeah, very high bounce rate, yeah.
Exactly. Folks come to Hacking with Swift repeatedly.
And they keep
coming. 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 times a month. They want more information. They know it's trustworthy. They know it's up to date. They know it's cared for and useful and free to use. They'll go there and trust it, which is what I want. I don't want folks to go to, you know, Stack Overflow, which is a pretty negative site to go to, where there's code from Swift 2 or Objective C code or just flat out wrong code. And I'd rather they took it from me, bluntly.
True. So if you look at your regular week, so to speak, a week has 7 days. Do you stick to a Monday to Friday or are you always coding?
Oh, no. I work really strange hours. I mean, really, really strange hours. And some folks have spotted that, partly because Big Sur does not let you hide the clock anymore. You've got to have the clock always there. My number one priority, no matter how much I love coding, my number one priority is not Swift.
Mm-hmm.
I know I've got two kids, right?
Yeah.
One's 10, one's 7. That's way more important than any kind of Swift coding I can do.
Yeah.
And so I work really strange hours. I want to make sure that when they are home, we are doing homework or watching TV or playing games or having dinner or something together that we're doing. Yeah. And when they're in bed around 9 o'clock in the evening, that's when I can start work again.
Mm-hmm.
So I work very odd hours sometimes around the family stuff because it's just a priority. And that might mean very often working weekends.
Mm-hmm.
Again, once the kids are in bed, you know, I'm not doing it 2 in the afternoon if possible.
Mm-hmm.
I'm doing it late in the evening once they're in bed. I'd rather do that than sacrifice my weeknights and, you know, have family time lost.
Yeah.
So I work really strange hours.
So how old are your kids right now?
The oldest one's 10, and she's done 2 talks already, by the way. She talked at NS Spain 10 days ago and at UIConf in May. And the little one is 7.
Yeah, I got a 2-year-old and a 5-year-old at home, and it's true. If they're busy, if they need attention, then nothing else matters.
Yeah, but I very clearly remember having this horrible moment when the older one, who was smaller at the time, said, "You know, Daddy, do you want to play with me?" And I was like, "No, I'm working right now."
Mm-hmm.
And like, wow, did I really just say that? Did I really just say, "No, I don't want to play with my small child. I want to sit and do work instead"? Obviously, I've got to earn money to do well, whatever, but it didn't sit well with me. So I try hard. I don't always succeed. I'm sitting around dub-dub. It's a real write-off for my family. They know that. Mm-hmm. We plan around that. Same for Hacking with Swift Live. That's a 4-day series of live workshops, and that took a lot of work from me to prepare and da-da-da. And, of course, all the money went to charity, so I didn't get any pennies from that. But it made a difference, so it was good.
Yeah. So and how's your wife with you, working the strange hours and all these kinds of things, and just doing something like for very dedicated for a couple of days, because there's no other option then. So how does she handle that?
Yeah, so Dub Dub obviously is a bit of a fire. So it was, we had June was Dub Dub, end of June, and then 10 days later approximately was my conference speaking about Dub Dub, and it was 4 days. We were both very, very tired. She'd been on full childcare duty for the entire time. I'd been working flat out to do the charity conference. It was intense. But we then had a massive family holiday. It was like, okay, well, let's take the next 2.5 weeks. We're going up to the middle of nowhere in Scotland. We're doing nothing, just walking around some hills. We walked around, climbed some hills, walked around some more, met some sheep. That was about it, right? We had a massive break.
But after an intense week, that can probably be one of the best things that you can actually do with a family.
Yeah, exactly. Just pure nature, no work at all, which is really nice. And then at the start of September, once the hotels had reopened, I think it was that approximately then, maybe August, I forget. Anyway, she had a whole week away. You just go to a hotel by yourself, do nothing, because you can do. Just go there. I'll look after the kids for a whole week as a recompense for WBC horrors.
Yeah, but that's sounds like fair trade, right?
Yeah, sort of. It's like when I go to a conference, I obviously enjoy it. It's good. Mm-hmm. But it's not the kind of glamorous thing you might expect. It's kind of hard going to a conference.
Yeah.
If I'm going to, I went to one it was Swift and Fika, a lovely event in Stockholm in 2018. Mm-hmm. And it was like, I've got to get the 5 a.m. bus to the airport for a 6 a.m. flight to whatever. It was proper crack of dawn stuff, pitch black outside, freezing cold, dragging a suitcase around, working on the plane, preparing my slides, working while I'm there, meeting folks, chatting, and then doing work in the evening, preparing my slides again. It's a lot of work going to events. Yeah. I really enjoy it, but it's not the happy lucky break you might imagine it is. Hey, he's going to San Jose, he's going to Singapore.
It's long days, I can imagine. So is there anything else that you wanted to mention or that you think like, okay, we should definitely mention this on your episode?
Just generally?
Yeah.
Wow. Well, if I can speak anything at all, there's something particular I'd like to speak about, which is every night for the last, 3 months or so, maybe 2.5 months, I've been watching a TV show with my kids called She-Ra. Mm-hmm. On Netflix, and I saw it when I was a kid, the old She-Ra from the 80s, right? It's nothing like that. It's remade by Netflix to a new TV show, and it was absolutely brilliant. We'd watch one episode every night for the entire time until we got through it all. Absolutely brilliant show, because not only is it full of very, very strong, powerful, exciting, interesting, heroic female characters, but it also does a really amazing job of representing diversity in the world they're showing in the cartoon. The original She-Ra from the 80s, everyone was sort of like a middle height, skinny white woman, because they were designed to be toys. They're designed to be sold as toys. And so making every character the same height, shape, size, color, they were cheap to make as toys. You can make a million of the same thing rather than, 100,000 of each. This new one was not designed that way, and so there's a variety of skin colors, a variety of sizes, skinny or larger and so forth, a variety of heights. They have all sorts, including an amazing non-binary character.
Mm-hmm.
They had, and the wonderful thing was, this person they're called Double Trouble, used the pronoun they, and everyone on the TV show, including the arch enemy, the worst possible person, respected that pronoun.
Yeah,
they were like, "You're they." And that says so much about them, that even the most evil person on the planet says they wouldn't misgender them. And so seeing this body positivity, gender positivity was amazing for a show, which is also full of laughs and action, other things too. I really enjoyed that, and I'd encourage folks, if you have kids, or quite frankly if you don't, check out She-Ra on Netflix. I think you'll enjoy it.
Yeah, because diversity is important, right?
Yeah, it is important. I think that's like a starting point, acknowledging that. But it's one of those things, again, I think we all have to actively fight for.
Yeah.
Actually, take a stand for and make a difference on, because we're so bad right now. And we're really bad right now.
So just because I know it's a topic that has a big mind share with you. me as a software developer, what is the advice that you would give to have a positive impact on this topic, on the topic of diversity and the bad things that are happening even nowadays?
I think the most important thing anyone can do, and this absolutely applies to me too, is to raise your own awareness significantly beyond what you think is normal.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been trying this for years. I've been trying super hard to listen to women, to people of color from around the world, just listening to their stories.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me what your life is like, reading their tweets, following people, interacting with them as much as I can, listening carefully, not talking, just listening. And even today, I read things and I'm like, wow, that surely cannot be the case. Even though I know it's true, I find it hard to believe. I know it's true. And I've been trying so hard for a long time now. And that's the nature of the privilege I have. That happened to be a middle-aged white dude from a rich Western country. Mm-hmm. I have no concept of what it means to be a poor black trans, Portuguese, someone, right? I have no idea.
Yeah.
And I have to listen very, very hard to even come close to that.
Mm-hmm.
And so folks have to understand, and I have to understand too, we are all massively biased in one direction. And we can try as hard as we'd like to come closer to where we need to be, but it's a lifelong mission, a lifelong piece of work to understand for me, and I think for everyone. And it's hard. It's really, really hard because you can think back, yeah, I'm woke. I totally get it. I understand it. Now I think women are great.
Yeah.
And that doesn't get you anywhere unless you're actively fighting for change. Actively, because anyone can, throw money at this. Here, mm-hmm. I'll give you some money. Just okay, you can give money. How about you sit down and mentor someone? Yeah. How about you sponsor someone? Like just in the last few days, I was asked to speak at a conference next year in January. Lovely conference, love it very much. I said, hey, I just want to check you've got a good diverse speaker lineup. He said, I'm sorry, we have managed to find no women to speak at the event. I'm like, no women in 2021? There's no women speaking.
There's like 50% out there, come on.
Well, yeah. I will not speak.
Yeah.
Unless that changes. And so I said, listen, I will talk to some women I know and trust, see if they'd love to speak. And I found two who'd love to speak, put them forward, put their names forward, and hey, I hope that's going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
But that's what it means. You know, anyone could just say, hey, I'll sponsor you. Here's £10, £20, whatever, €50 for your thing. That's good. That helps, makes a difference. But your time, giving up your actual time and your words and actions, doing something is way more important. And I hope that one day in the far, far future, whenever I die, my tombstone says, here lies Paul Hudson. He tried to do something. That's what I actually care about, making an actual difference to someone.
Okay. And I think that's actually a great point in our interview to actually wrap things up.
What, me dying? Yeah, it's great.
No, not that part. No, but I think we have a very concise history and of what how you actually became Hacking with Swift, and I think it's very admirable the way you conceptualize different things and how you actually produce content and what your motivations are behind actually giving this content and creating the content. And I thank you very much for your time. I really enjoyed our conversation, and I hope people will actually appreciate the points of view that you shared with us, and enjoy your history.
Well, if they don't, they can always unfollow me on Twitter. That's the magic of the internet, you know. I think I'm pretty shameless. I make my views very, very clear on Twitter how I feel about stuff.
Yeah.
I'm giving folks every opportunity to follow someone else instead. So, I think I'm okay. Yeah.
Thank you, Paul.
Thank you very much.
Lead Developer, best practices and tips for lead software developers. PDF, MOBI and EPUB format. appforce1.net/lead developer, all one word.